So hello everyone, maybe we should start now. Welcome to the Policy in Practice seminar. As you know, this is our flagship seminar series that my colleague Vanessa and I run with the support of Jemima, both of them here. And today we are very pleased to have Alan Hirsch with us to give the seminar. Alan Hirsch has an amazing background. I've known him for more than a decade. A background to this talk. So he has been both on the academic or teaching side as the founding director of the Nelson Mandela School of Public Policy, School of Public Governance, the leading school of public policy in Africa. And he has spent most of his career on the policy side, in the office of the president and different positions. I worked with him when he was country director for international, but was also contributing in many other dimensions. So he has not only worked in South Africa, but many other places. And even now, if anyone thought that there was anything as retirement, so he's as active as he was before. Like he's a member of the President Cyril Ramaphosa's Economic Advisory Council. He has so many other positions in EU and many other policy think tanks. And I know that he is very active, not only in South Africa in policy positions, but also elsewhere. And as I mentioned, he was for 8 years, he's still emeritus professor at the Nelson Mandela School. Based, as you can imagine, given the history of South Africa and given the legacy of Nelson Mandela, it also is not only a leading school of public policy in Africa, but also builds on the legacy of the one of the greatest persons that we have had in human history, Nelson Mandela. So thank you very much, Alan. It's a real pleasure to have you with us. And let's open it up. So for the benefit of the audience, I'm giving you this background because then you can also ask Alan about multiple things. One obvious thing is South Africa. It's transformation. It's both political, but also economic transformation, the policy challenges. So that's one theme that you could be discussing. The other is School of Public Policy, how to get this balance right between policy, analytical skill, how do you get a new school running, which is a huge challenge, especially in a place where there are not too many, Africa, but also South Africa, but which is also I think good governance and public policy is also perhaps needed the most, sub-Saharan Africa, so South Africa also. So that's the other thing that you could be talking about, public policy. How do you teach those? How do you practice those? The third is, I would also say, like he's also has a great experience with Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, the southern part of it more, but all over South. If you want to talk about African transformation, potential challenges, is Africa rising? How could it be, we could support Africa rising? Again, Alan Hirsch has a great perspective. And then there are many other issues on global economic governance, policy, things that you could be talking about. If any of you wants to work in Africa or wants advice, maybe you could you can ask some version of that today and maybe ask for his advice separately as well. So I don't want to I'm conscious of managing expectations, but I know Alan very well and I think he's absolutely the best person to be speaking at the seminar. So without further ado, thank you very much, Alan. Over to you. The way we'll run this, Alan will share his thoughts about South Africa, about school, and any other thing that he wants to talk about. And we'll spend most of today on question answer and a discussion with you participating. So be ready with your thoughts, reflections, questions. But now, welcome again, Alan, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Adnan. And Thank you very much, Vanessa and Jemima, for facilitating. It's great to be involved. I've had various associations with the LSE, and it's great to make a connection again. I just want to say a few words of introduction about South Africa. South Africa, as I'm sure you all know, is a middle-income country, upper-middle-income country in Africa. It has a similar income per capita as Brazil, and it has a more unequal distribution of income than any other major country in the world that is properly measured. So it's a very, very, even 27 years after the democratic, or 28 years after the democratic transformation, the battle to reverse the apartheid system hasn't been won yet. And that's a big part of the political challenge that faces South Africa. Let me just say a few words about my involvement. I grew up in Cape Town, studied at the University of Cape Town in Johannesburg, then at Columbia in New York. I taught at UCT for a while, but then I went into government as soon as I could after the democratic transition, working in the trade and industry department as the chief director of industry and technology strategy, which was a job that I had to work day and night harder than I'd ever worked before. But I enjoyed it more than any other job that I've had actually before or since, in the sense that we really were doing stuff that was important and that you could see the impact. I went away for a year. I had a fellowship at Harvard. When I came back, I was employed in the president's office as the chief economic policy person. Basically, we had a policy unit, and there was a 5 sections, and I was in charge of the economic section. And then I was promoted to a higher level within the presidency. I was the deputy head of the policy unit. The head was a very senior sort of cabinet level person, very good man, Joel Nichitenge. And then I did various things, like I was the G20 Sherpa, I was the co-chair of the G20 Development Working Group, and I did a lot of policy work in the presidency, developing really economic development strategy and helping to try to get coordination between government departments, which is a hard thing to do in a parliamentary system, a very hard thing to do. And particularly where you have a political party like the ruling party in South Africa, which is very divided and fragmented. Then I went back when I had been in government. I was still in the president's office, and I was able to remain when...
Sorry, Flavia, can you... Okay, go ahead.
So when President Zuma came in, I sort of gave it a couple of years, but then realized I wasn't comfortable working in his office, and went back to the University of Cape Town to start the Nelson Mandela School of Public Governance, which I was very, very excited about, and used my political capital, because in the kind of work I'd had, I'd generated a lot of political capital, and I thought, what can I do with that political capital? I can build a new institution. And actually, it was a challenge to do it at UCT, because University of Cape Town, through the apartheid era, had been quite distant from government, being a liberal university, white university, but as because of the apartheid system, although it made a big effort to sort of break down that racial barrier, and there were various ways of getting around those racial barriers, but still a liberal institution, or left liberal institution, which was didn't work closely with government. And that tradition of not working with government continued even into the democratic era. So I felt I was going back to my alma mater and the school that I really loved to try to bring it closer to public purpose, which it hadn't really been structurally before. South Africa faces a massive challenge of inequality and unemployment. It's a fragmented society. It's a society which which is very peculiar. One of the most peculiar things about it is that, you know, when you look at the elite in society, normally in most countries you have a situation where there is a relatively significant intersection between the political elite and the economic elite. At the point of democratic transition, the economic elite was entirely white and the political elite was virtually entirely black. They hadn't been to the same schools, they didn't listen to the same music, they didn't support the same soccer teams. There was a massive cultural gap, and that made things terribly difficult. Building trust within our society has been one of the most difficult things to do. And the big challenge really was to try to build a black middle class and a black bourgeoisie, a black capitalist class, because although the politics of the ANC are social democratic, they were certainly pro-market and they've always been pro-market. But we haven't been able to reduce the inequalities as quickly as we would have wanted to. And that made it possible for a kind of a populism to emerge in South Africa under the leadership of Zuma, who became President Zuma, who brought together a sort of populist grouping into government and used a kind of a left populism as a mask for an extremely rapacious, corrupt system. I guess there are some parallels in other parts of Africa, certainly parallels in Latin America and probably other parts of the world as well. The remarkable thing, though, is that within the democratic system, we seem to be clawing our way back from this really serious problem of corruption and poor policy and looting of the state, with a president who's taken a very cautious route of gradually establishing the power of a reformist grouping within the ANC, the ruling party, and within government, and gradually rooting out the opportunist and corrupt elements, or the more opportunist and more deeply corrupt elements in the organization, to try to get things back onto a sound footing. And it's still a kind of a delicate balance, but at this point, the balance does seem in favor of the forces of reform. So that's my introduction. I'll open up.
Great, thanks, Alan. Let's open up, but before that, do you want to say something about South African economic trajectory? There were and still are high hopes for South African economic transformation. So there was a concern at the time of the big political transition in 1994, about not only continued economic growth, but also equality, concerned with inequality. And how do you see the policy challenges there, and what role can policy analysts and maybe your school or others can play in that? So it's not just politics, but also policy.
Yeah, it's a big one. So for those of you who are really interested in following up that question, I've recently published with some colleagues a paper through the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C., which is called When Institutions and Inequality Clash. And it's kind of a political economy of the recent history of South Africa, and trying to explain how we got to where we got to and where we could possibly get to. But for those of you who haven't read it and probably won't read it, I would summarize it as follows. So in the period leading up to the political transition in 1994, the apartheid system, which had depended heavily on cheap labor, because it wasn't an entirely irrational system. It was a system which was economically rational insofar as black workers were almost enslaved. It was a very, it was a labor repressive institution where the mines and the farms, which were the main economic activities for most of South Africa's modern history, depended on very cheap labor. There were a range of reasons why that was the case. That worked in terms of capitalist accumulation for a period of time, but it got to the point where the mines started to run out and the farms were becoming increasingly capital intensive, where that political system and the economic system no longer kind of worked together in the favor of the elite. And the last 10 years of apartheid were years of negative per capita growth, of stagnation, of crisis. So when the ANC took over as the democratically elected government in 1994, the economy was really weak. So the challenge was to rebuild the economy and to address the inequality issue at the same time, which was really difficult. In fact, it turned out to be impossible. The ANC chose at that point to take what the sort of perhaps slightly unkind critics would call a neoliberal position, effectively to a large extent at that point. To some extent, because try and put yourself in the place of President Mandela at the time. This is 1994. Rwanda is in turmoil. Yugoslavia is in turmoil. Ireland is in turmoil. There are civil wars all over the world. And it's a point at which most African countries are not doing very well economically at all. It's a point after about 20 years of low commodity prices, which means that most African countries were in a pretty bad economic state, and some had been badly run as well. So just to be in Africa and to be a black leader in Africa, put yourself at the subject to enormous prejudice around the world. You had to prove yourself as an effective leader, even more than any other leader of a new state. And there was a lot of pressure on Mandela and the government at the time not to change things too much, to allow for a smooth economic transition. So there wasn't a massive redistribution of wealth. There wasn't a massive intervention. There was the introduction of competition policy, which tried to break up the very big monopolistic companies which ran South Africa and in many ways continued to run South Africa, to some extent successful. And there were other incremental interventionist approaches which worked for a while. So you get to a point where by the mid noughties, 2004 to 2008 or so, South Africa is growing steadily at a rate of around 5% per annum, which was better than it had for a very long time. Then came the global economic crisis, hit South Africa very badly. So those of you who are economists will know that in a way the world was hit in two different ways. The developed world was hit with a credit crisis, massive collapse in credit in the developed countries, and the developing world largely with a trade and investment crisis. South Africa was in the middle because it had a deep financial markets and deep credit markets and a massive contraction of credit at the same time as it also had commodity prices collapsing and all the other kind of trade and investment losses that developing countries had. So it was very bad. South Africa still hasn't really recovered post the global financial crisis, and that's partly because the Zuma government, which was in power from about that time onwards, didn't have the capability or the commitment to rebuild the economy effectively, the ability to do that. So we've been muddling along as we put it, for the last 10 or 15 years, sometimes having contractionary fiscal policies, sometimes having expansionary policies, with a number of initiatives for economic development, but at the moment, not very good. So the IMF economic outlook for South Africa in the April report was that we would grow at a rate of somewhere over 3% this year, which is about half of the world average of 6% in the current IMF estimate. And we shouldn't be growing at half of the world estimate. We should be historically up to the global financial crisis, we grew at roughly the world rate of growth, not better, not worse. So there's a lot of rebuilding to do, and I think a lot of economic restructuring to do, and the issues of inequality still need to be addressed effectively.
Thank you, Alan.
The role of public policy, and there's a lot of public policy activism. You know, what was very exciting about this period of corruption was that the media, the judiciary, and academia stood up and intervened. So academics were doing research, showing the corruption that was taking place. The media was publicizing it. The judiciary were basically being responsible in response to the various problems. So there were some very exciting developments in terms of the involvement of intellectuals in trying to address those challenges.
Thank you, Alan. I realize that I give too broad and too big a question, but you, despite the nature of my question, you gave a great response. Let me ask you more question and then open up. And this is more about like bringing your own work and the School of Public Policy into it. South Africa had a peculiar, difficult history. It went through a miraculous transition. And then the subsequent challenges were huge expectations of, maybe rightly justified expectations of change in the lives of the people, their circumstances. Some of it was realized politically, but maybe not so economically, or at least in the time period, or in the speed, or in the time frame that people expected. Huge political challenges for a party that was the call it like the darling of everyone around the world who looked up to democracy, evolutionary change, and a leader who is still one of the most respected leaders in human history. For that party and that politics to within a period of 10 to 15 years to get down to the level of what happened during the Zuma administration. So maybe I'm revealing too much about my own politics, but it does raise the question about like the nature of political competition. And one thing that I want to comment about is it has, at least in my view, some parallels with what happened in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, where there were huge hopes around the time of in many of those places, many of those expectations and hopes were dashed. Among other reasons, for the reason that the liberation movements of yesterday, which were very popular, didn't become, when they were actually ruling and running governments, didn't perform as well. So liberation movements became one-party states in many countries and decayed over time. That fortunately hasn't happened in South Africa, and it looks like there is a self-correcting mechanism that we are seeing recently. But I want you to also relate it to School of Public Policy. You also mentioned policy challenges. What kind of economic policies should we have? In a country where politics is divided, where there is a unique history, where they're not, call it like consensus on what should be done, public policy is not also that simple. And you tried to build a world-class institute in the context of South Africa, obviously to support South Africa's policy and growth. But it's also like a leading institute in Africa. So you have students from all over. So say something about your vision for the school and how you actually try to translate that vision into how students are prepared. So like, what's your vision for the students also? How do you prepare them for the type of challenges that they face? Not just in South Africa, we discussed some of those, but also in the rest of, especially Africa, where these questions of governance, politics, often bad policies, have often stood in the way of Africa not being able to realize its full potential. So I want to, and maybe you could say something about your personal journey also, why you decided to take on this challenge. You have been into some of the top positions, Office of the Presidency, Economic Advisors, all kinds of positions. And living up to the name of Nelson Mandela must have been a unique challenge. So say something about your own motivation, vision, and how and what role, like what do you think about, like how would you prepare students to be, to do better in future in terms of public policy and development?
Okay, so that's a big one. So I'll try not to take too long. In terms of my personal journey, I have to talk about my father. My father, Herbert Hirsch, who died 2 years ago, he was a refugee, Jewish refugee from Germany, came to South Africa when he was 7 or 8 years old. And grew up in a situation where most Jews who'd come across from Germany and other parts of Europe at different times in the 20th century didn't get involved in politics, didn't, you know, kept their heads down, you know, kind of had the attitude, this is enough, we've had enough, we don't want to take on other people's problems. But my father never did that. So he was politically engaged from early on. He was a member of the Liberal Party. He became, when the Liberal Party was banned, because non-racial political parties were banned in the 60s, he became a member of the whites-only Progressive Party. He was a leader of, you know, he knew it was a compromise, but he thought that it was a compromise that he could make a difference being in the system. You know, I supported him, although I never was a member of his party, and I never intended to be a member of his party. But I was inspired by his humanism, his commitment to a better society, his bravery, really, in a difficult situation. I remember once when he was burying publications in the garden because we were afraid that there was going to be a raid. This was after the banning of the Liberal Party. So he, you know, in so many ways that I don't want to bore you with, was my inspiration. And he taught me to not be a typical white South African. And, you know, for a long time, I was kind of a little bit apart in some ways from the rest of my peers. Fortunately, most of them grew towards where I was. So the ANC, you know, remains in power 27 years approximately after the transition. It is a liberation dividend. You often get a liberation dividend. In India, you had the Congress Party's liberation dividend. In Japan, you had the Liberal Party's kind of liberation dividend. They were the single party in power for many, many years. Sometimes it doesn't work very well. Perhaps in the case of the Congress Party, like the ANC, it didn't work all that well. You had a situation of increasing incumbency leading to corruption, leading to all kinds of divisions. The ANC, like most liberation movements, was a very broad church politically. It had traditionalists, it had liberals, social liberals, it had socialists, it had sort of free marketeers. It was a very broad church. The only thing that really held it together was a firm belief in the anti-apartheid struggle and the need and making that the primary focus. So that also meant that when the political party came to power, there were many different points of view. So when I was in the trade and industry department in the 90s, in 1 year, in 1996, under President Mandela's leadership, three different ministers produced three different economic policy documents that were effectively competing with each other. They were all adopted, and only one of them was really implemented in part. So you had this system which wasn't fully functional. It wasn't a tight structure then. It isn't a tight structure now. It's not a presidential system. It's a parliamentary system. So the president the president in our case could be called a prime minister in many countries, is somebody who doesn't have a huge amount of executive power. So the ministries and the provinces, you know, often moved in different directions. And the real challenge, when I was in government, the real challenge, especially when I was in the presidency, realizing how little power the president actually had, only power he had was to fire or hire ministers. And that was limited by his relationship to the political party, because the political party structures had a lot of control over who was appointed to the ministries anyway. In spite of that, I think things went pretty well until the Zuma group basically was elected. So there was a certain amount of corruption in the Mandela period, even to a small extent in the Mbeki period. President Thabo Mbeki was the second president. He had almost two 5-year terms. The second term was cut short. And at that point, I still felt it was viable working in government. I felt that experts were still respected, and that's kind of almost like a key signifier for me is, you know, what is the role of an expert? What is the role of a senior official in the government? But that shifted dramatically under Zuma, and he started having cabinet meetings excluding officials, almost every official, whereas Thabo Mbeki had an annual meeting, a biannual meeting, where you had about 200 people in the room, the ministers, the premiers of the provincial governments, the senior officials from national and provincial government and from the presidency, all in the room, all reviewing policy and talking about the policy process going forward. One of the most immediate changes Zuma made was to say cabinet meets on its own, cabinet ministers only, and then the officials are called in afterwards and they're told what to do. And that to me was a sort of sign that, you know, there wasn't much I could contribute anymore. And I thought that, you know, my experience of working in the South African government and my experience of working with officials from other African governments was that there are a lot of good people in government. There are a lot of good people who are in managerial positions or professional positions in African governments. Sometimes they have the opportunity to fulfill their potential and to do what they are employed to do. Other times it's really, really difficult. So what I thought with my colleagues in setting up the school, and one of my colleagues is Brian Levy, who was at the World Bank for a long time, also teaches at Johns Hopkins. We thought we want to empower the officials, the sort of middle level and senior officials in African governments to be what we call public entrepreneurs. And public entrepreneurs are people who can understand, who basically understand what the environment is. So you're working in a circumstance of great difficulty. in a Zuma administration where your options are limited. World Bank comes to you. Actually, this isn't fair because by that time the World Bank had changed quite a lot. But in most of my period in government, the World Bank comes to you and says, you know, this is what you should be doing. This is what they're doing in Mauritius and what they're doing in Argentina. And we're sure it's going to work in South Africa as well. Instead of really trying to understand what the specific circumstances in the country are, who has power, who has the ability to block change, what are the coalitions that can drive a reform forward. So we teach political economy, we teach how to understand organizations, and we try to empower officials who, and the kind of people who come to our school, just like the kind of people who come to your school, are the kind of people who are in government or are working with government because they want to make a difference. We make that assumption. It's, you know, it's entirely a justified assumption. So we try to give them the scope to be able to achieve the objectives, do what they're a hospital manager, they're a official in the president's office responsible for environment policy, they're the manager of the export promotion program, whatever they are. We try to help them to analyze their organization, their circumstances, their country, the conditions they're working under so that they can be more effective. So we actually started the school with executive courses, partly because it was easier and we wanted to build a kind of an African network. And we, from the outset, we wanted to be African. We thought it would be really boring if we were and actually depressing if we were a purely South African school, because everybody would have the same story and nobody would learn from each other. If you bring Africans from all over, they have different stories and they can learn from each other. So we had executive courses, and then we had a part-time master's program where people came for two-week blocks, four times over a two-year period. That meant we were targeting mid-career people who had the experience, who brought their experience into the room, could learn from each other. And that's what we built the school around. We now have a full-time master's program as well, and a PhD program and various research initiatives. But the ethos of the school was built around working with public servants and people working in aid organizations, international organizations, and so on, who are in their positions trying to understand how to do their job better.
Thank you, Alan, for sharing your personal journey. And what you said is extremely important. I hope all of us would keep that in mind. Working with policymakers and decision makers, and not only sharing their experiences and their stories, but also helping them do their job better through better analytics, but also through other means that you mentioned. I think that's a very valuable and worthwhile goal that you have put. We can discuss more and more, and I'm sure there'll be questions. So I think I've, before I open up, I'm reminded of a book that I read a few years ago about South Africa, How to Steal a City, the battle for control of Nelson Mandela Bay, an insider account. I think it was Crispian Oliver who wrote that fascinating book. It's not a manual for corruption. It's like it describes the entire culture of corruption and how that became a systematic, organized, and how ANC, the Liberation Party, also fell victim to it under especially the Zuma years. So
he's a medical doctor. And he's got a PhD in somewhere anthropology or something. He's now doing his PhD with us, working with Brian Levy to try to work systematically through those issues in a more systematic way. Because that book, which is a brilliant book, is purely descriptive, and now he's sort of moving towards a more analytical position.
Fantastic. I met him in a few years ago in London when he was visiting. Great person. Required. I would strongly recommend that book also. It's a great account of. It's depressing at one level, but it's also like hopeful and inspiring in terms of how one person or a group of persons could basically defy the system and keep on working despite all the odds stacked against them. I think it's a question that many of us have also faced. When we'll be working in real systems, especially when there are organized and entrenched systems of corruption and patronage, what can an individual do? Yeah. Or what can a group of people do? So I found it inspiring and depressing at the same time. So I would strongly recommend you to read that. It's great that and is associated with your school. So that's great to know. Maybe at some stage we should also invite him and talk to him. Over to you, Vanessa, and all of the colleagues, whosoever wants to. Just come into the conversation. You don't have to raise your hand, but if you want, you can raise your real or virtual hand.
A little bit more on Crispin Olver, who's everybody knows as Chippy. He was the Director General of Environment for a long time in national government. He's now leading the climate change implementation group for government. So he's definitely somebody to talk to.
We will definitely reach out to him and talk to him. Thank you, Alan. So who wants to come and do the discussion now? Yeah, I don't know who came first, but Kristen and Jatit.
Shall I just start?
yeah, please.
Thank you very much for this super interesting talk. I'm going to disclose how really, really old I am. I actually studied at the University of Cape Town in 1998, 1999, and I still have very wonderful memories. It was really a fascinating time. It was only a few years after Nelson Mandela became the president. And I think I'm going to go back in history a little bit because it's I'm drawing some questions from my past and if it's still relevant today. I remember that there was this general feeling and intense enthusiasm of improving the country overall politically, democratically, and also economically. And for me, the two things that stood out most at the time was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where I remember we attended a hearing. And I was wondering to what extent that has helped democratically to create some cohesion. And the second one was the Employment Equity Act, I think it was called at the time, in order to give preference to Black people or colored people when it comes to employment. And I was also, and before the background of the diversity of the country, you don't just have white South Africans and Black South Africans, you have, I think, over 11 languages and a number of ethnicities and nations and different cultures. And to what extent is there a lack of cohesion? Is that the problem? And we visited last year again, because we still have a lot of friends. And they said they still have a big, big problem with unemployment, a lot of young people. So the population development is a problem in itself, because there seem to be not enough jobs for the young people. So I was wondering, is this combination of a lot of young people, and maybe is there a problem of cohesion maybe between the different groups, or are they all pulling into the same direction to improve the country? And that is, of course, separate from the problem of corruption, which I think is a problem in any country that faces corruption to get better at the economic level. So it's I'm sorry. It's a very it's a combined question, but I think it's trying to look at the sociology of the population, if that is maybe something to think about or address in order to improve the economic situation.
Shall I respond? There's quite a lot there. So, Kirsten, I mean, the interesting thing about South Africa is that the unemployment problem is less a problem of the oversupply of people, but more of a problem of the undersupply of jobs and the undersupply of skills. So if you look at the population growth rate in South Africa today, it is somewhere around about 1.5 or 1.6%, which is more or less at the transition, or the demographic transition, to almost, you know, so it's one of the slowest population growths in Africa, similar to North Africa and a few other parts of Africa. So, you know, it wouldn't be honest of us to say the problem is too many people. The problem is too few jobs, and the problem is too few skills. We have had a really slow economic growth rate for the first 15 years or so after the transition, and the period that you were there, perhaps not so much because it was a difficult period, the late 90s. There were financial crises in Russia and in Latin America and in Asia that affected South Africa as well. So it wasn't a good period. But in the 10 years after that, up to 2008, 2009, there was really, you know, good economic growth and good job creation. And the unemployment rate, and some of you are not going to believe these numbers, but the unemployment rate reduced from about 32% about 2002 to 20% or 21% in 2008, 2009. So it was quite a significant reduction. But after that, we've had really, really poor growth. The TRC, I think, made an important contribution for a while. And I think that, like Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, you know, will always be remembered as, you know, one of the great figures both in Africa and around, in South Africa and around the world, as an incredible man of peace and man of ingenuity and a man of compassion. And that was a very cathartic and difficult period. But the problem was that a lot of people who were guilty of apartheid crimes were not prosecuted. And a lot of the people who considered themselves to be victims of apartheid crimes were not compensated in their perception effectively. So it, in the long run, the TRC is, looking back on it, some people think it was putting a band-aid on a much bigger wound. It was the right thing to do, but it didn't really go nearly far enough. I don't think Tutu could have taken it further at the time, or Mandela, but it wasn't enough. And what is required is the reduction of inequality. So you talk about the Employment Equity Act. It's one of many interventions. So after the Employment Equity Act is not very interventionist. It's basically saying that companies have to report on an annual basis to the Department of Labor who is employed in what kind of position. So how many women and men and black people, and then to talk about the population definitions, we have 11 official languages, we have more, 11 official languages. We have black South Africans who are of African origin. We have people who are called colored, who are people of mixed origin, some of African origin, of European origin, of Asian origin, especially Southeast Asia. And then we have people who have a much more clearly South Asian origin, who are called Indians, but there may be Indians or Sri Lankans in origin, and whites. So it's very, very complicated. And at one point, in fact, Durban was the city, South Africa's third largest city, which was the city with the largest Indian population outside of India. It's not a huge population, but it's significant. So it's complicated. It's very, very complicated. If you look at so companies had to report how each of those groups, and in terms of gender as well, were doing. And the only pressure that was on them was the pressure of public exposure. There wasn't a sanction. And even now, government doesn't intervene directly and say, you don't have enough black directors, you don't have enough women directors, you've got to change your structure, or you don't have enough black professionals. There are attempts to persuade firms to change their behavior and to change their practices. And there are various kinds of incentives. So some government programs may be conditional on certain kinds of behavior by firms, but there's no direct intervention in the way that firms operate even now. So what we actually had, I mean, what happened in practice was that there were quite a lot of qualified black professionals who were in a position to be appointed to positions of responsibility in the public sector, and that happened quickly, and in the private sector, and that happened quite quickly, but then it reached a kind of a ceiling, and that ceiling hasn't been surpassed, and still a large proportion of owners and managers and senior professionals in the private sector are white. So I think that's some of the, you know, that's giving you a bit of trying to sort of catch you up to the present. One of the big interventions is called Black Economic Empowerment. And Black Economic Empowerment was trying to take the employment equity process further, and finding ways to encourage the promotion of Black-owned firms and the promotion of Black ownership in firms which are not originally Black. They might be foreign, they might be owned by white South Africans or whatever. That worked to a certain extent as well, but then it also became a means of corruption. So what we had was relationships being established by government officials between particular firms that were black owned and particular clients of government which wanted favors, and that became a very poisonous situation. So Black economic empowerment has got quite badly corrupted and needs to be rethought and re-engineered. It's still absolutely necessary, but it didn't work all that well.
Thank you. So now we have Jay, who is an aspiring politician, and I'm hoping that you'll not be discouraged by all of this discussion of politics having gone bad, but you'll hopefully take the positive lessons here. Jay, and then we have a question from Bethany that I will read out.
Thank you very much, Adnan. I think, I mean, if I were to be discouraged by politics, India has been doing that to me for a long time. So hopefully I can stay on. I mean, thank you very much for joining us today, Alan. Thank you, Adnan, for giving me the chance to ask a question. I think you very briefly touched upon some of the bits that I was hoping to ask you about just now. So I'm originally from India, and I wanted to ask the question about quota systems as a policy tool and to hopefully draw some parallels to India. So probably to give some quick context to the wider audience, we have reservation or quota systems in India, which were mandated to be effective in our constitution till around 1960, if my memory serves right. To help lift the more oppressed sections of society. But I don't think this has entirely worked, and the size of reservation quotas have only increased in many contexts, like education and employment in the 60 years since. So Alan, please, could you share some thoughts on the use of reservation quotas as a policy? So your thoughts on their efficacy and importance in bringing about equality or equity, their impact on electoral politics. Do you think there's a more effective tool and should we be looking at to face our reservations? So fairly broad question, but I trust that you'll give us a more concise answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's a great and clear question. Quotas, I think, as in India and as in other countries, become very hot issues. So in South Africa, as some of you will know, especially those countries which play cricket and rugby, sport is incredibly important to South Africans. And one of the areas in which quotas became an issue was actually in sports teams. So some South African sports teams, like the football or soccer team, was black enough already because of the demographics of football in South Africa. But because most of the players in the elite rugby and cricket teams are recruited from the private schools, they were mostly white, and there were quotas that were introduced. I think the quotas worked quite well, not so much at the national level, but at other levels. So if you do it at the youth level and at the provincial level, and they're done in a sort of judicious way, and there are carrots that are involved as well as sticks. So the carrots would be some sort of incentive and some sort of support for training and recruitment and so on. It can have a positive impact. And the fact that the Rugby World Cup in 2019 was won by a South African team with a captain who is black and from a poor black background, was very important. It was actually very important for South Africa. It did help to bring South Africans together. Sport does when you're doing well. The interesting thing about his story is that he wouldn't have been a sports star if it hadn't been for the quota system. So the schools were looking for talented, the private schools were looking for talented black rugby players. So they went around to the townships, to the poorer schools, looking for talent. And when they found a black potential, capable sports player who could also do okay in the school, they recruited them and they gave them scholarships. And that's what happened to Siya Kolisi. He came from a very, very poor background, and he was spotted and recruited by one of the rugby playing teams in the Eastern Cape. And so quotas can work up to a point. I think when you have unrealistic quotas and at the national level, it becomes very difficult and very political. So what we did in government, there was a target that was set. Essentially, we wanted government to become representative of the population as a whole. So the population being X percent black, X percent colored, Indian, white, and so on. It's kind of could get a bit mechanical and sometimes quite farcical. And I actually wrote an op-ed piece, which I never published, about the farce that can be encountered in those kinds of processes. But I was advised not to publish it, and probably was wise at the time. But what we did was to say, okay, first of all, when we recruit for government, we will make an effort to make sure that the advertisement is seen by potential black applicants. And then when we do the shortlisting, we will make sure that if there are good black applicants, that they are included in the shortlist. And then the rule of thumb was that if there were more or less equal candidates, and one was black and one was white, the black candidate would be employed you know, until your organization got to the point where that didn't matter anymore. And when that rule was applied, you know, effectively in that kind of way, it was fine. The problem was that, like the Black economic empowerment system, this system became distorted and used for political patronage and used to, you know, bring in clients of various kinds into organizations. So there is a risk that when you try to social engineer change, that it can be abused by people who want to abuse those kinds of systems. As for alternatives, well, I think the system we use in government, when it worked right, was a good one to say, make sure that that potential Black applicants see it. And if there is a kind of a toss-up between a white candidate and a Black candidate, and you don't have enough Black people in your organization, then you have to go for the Black candidate. And that, I don't think did any, when it was applied in that way, I don't think it did any damage to the organizations. The problem was it was vulnerable to distortion.
Thank you, Ellen. So Rai, I'll come to you in a minute. I have two questions on the chat from people who are...
Jayat here wants to come back.
Jay, you want to come?
Sorry, just very quickly, hopefully a very short question on the last point that you mentioned, right? Now, I can see how this works as a policy where it's helping uplift the more marginalized communities when it's the Black population, and when you're looking at Black versus white. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on how this extends to situations where there are as many communities as we have in the Indian context, for instance, right? So there are multiple quota mm-hmm. systems, and it's not just Black v white. So how does that potentially translate? And I'll stop there. But thank you very much.
It was a multiple system as well, in the sense that there were four main population groups, and there was a kind of a different quota for each of them. So it was complicated. But I think, you know, if it was applied in a fair and transparent way, it could work. I think it's so open to abuse, so vulnerable, that it often isn't. But I think that, I think with the caste system in India and with the apartheid system in South Africa and with the, you know, history of inequality in countries like the United States of America, you cannot rely on employers making wise decisions. Subconsciously, there's so many unconscious biases in employment processes. You know, there are unconscious biases towards people who went to the same university as you. There are subconscious biases to people who speak the same language or come from the same religious group or whatever it is. So there's a lot of risk involved. Not doing it, I'm not sure what the alternatives are. And everybody says in South Africa, you know, you shouldn't have quotas. What you should be doing is training more people, making the market more competitive, bringing people in at lower levels of the organization and getting them promoted. But the fact is that unconscious bias works, and that doesn't allow people to move up the organizations at the rate that they should.
Thank you both. Rai, I'll come to you in a minute. I have had two questions on the private chat from people on this call who are sitting in a silent zone and cannot use their mic and so let me ask on their behalf. Both of those questions are the School of Governance, Nelson Mandela School of Governance. Let me ask them separately, although they're to some extent also related. First, Bethany Carter, who is on this call, she's asking a very relevant question. What are the core skills or knowledge you structured your academic programs around and want every graduate of the Nelson Mandela School to leave with?
Okay. So I mentioned that we do that in a way, the key skills that we think we can provide that we think distinguishes our program from some other programs is the political economy and the organizational strategy skill set. And by organizational strategy, I don't mean conventional. I mean thinking about how organizations work in the real world rather than how organizations are supposed to work. So understanding power in organizations, understanding power between organizations, those sort of skills are very important. We have programs on ethics, and those are done mostly through case work. So we have cases that are worked through with students around ethical issues, because as somebody mentioned, several people have mentioned, in Africa and in other parts of the world, people are often faced with the challenge of working in an ethical environment and how do you deal with it. We have leadership skills. So we have fairly traditional kind of leadership skills development. And then we have some content. My teaching module is called Issues in African Economic Development, and that's probably very similar to a course that would be taught at LSE or elsewhere on African economic development. You're looking at, you're bringing people in a public policy school together around a common language of understanding what does development mean, what's the relationship between state and market, inequality and poverty, what's structural transformation, and why is it a challenge in Africa? Those sort of issues. So there's several content programs. There's work on evidence-based policy making and monitoring and evaluation. So that's a very important part of the program as well. I think those are the key elements. I'm just trying to think if there's a content. Yeah, there's also some content work on sort of a sociology of sort of political sociology, effectively. There is a political sociology component as well. So there's economic development, political sociology, monitoring, evaluation, evidence-based policy, and then the other skills that I talked about earlier.
Thanks, Alan and Bethany. So before I move to people on this call, so we also have a question from Santina Bergoa, who is, we can see, but she can't use her mic. She's asking the question about what are the main difficulties you face in founding a school? And maybe also what excited you the most in founding the school, and how is it perceived in the public sector in South Africa?
Main difficulty, well, it was funny. The first thing was to find a home within the university. I'm not sure if the structure is the same, but Cape Town University is divided into a sort of old-fashioned structure of humanities, commerce, science, medicine, and so on. And the logical home for most of us in terms of our training and our skills would have been humanities. But actually the right place was commerce, because commerce understood, the Faculty of Commerce understood what professional training was about. The approach of the humanities department was too sort of blue stocking in orientation. In the end, I think they wished that we had come to them, because we turned out to be relatively successful. Other issues were, the great thing was, I wouldn't have started the school if I hadn't had really good people to work with. So I had a friend, Brian Levy, who had been working in the World Bank and teaching at Johns Hopkins, who was very, very keen to work on the project and had a strong content background. And I had another friend, Jude Cornell, who was working in UNESCO in Paris, who wanted to come back to South Africa. He was a brilliant organizer. So you have to have a strong leadership team. I don't think one person can do it on their own. Then we found the right faculty. We found the faculty with the dean that was going to support us. And then it was a question of finding the money. That's a big, big issue. It's very, very, it's much harder to raise money for teaching than it is for research. And at the outset, our view was the difficult thing really is the teaching part. UCT has very good research centers, but it doesn't do this kind of teaching. And so we mostly raised money indirectly by doing projects with organizations that would fund those projects, and then we would cream off some sort of overheads, which we would use to cross-subsidize into the academic programs. So we were cross-subsidizing from our executive programs and from some research programs into the teaching programs. And we're probably still doing that, although we have managed to raise more money for teaching through funding chairs and getting people to fund scholarships in the school. But that was my job was marketing, fundraising, and a bit of vision.
Thanks, Alan. I'm sure it would have been a very difficult but also an exciting journey. You mentioned, so for the benefit of others, Brian Levy is a very thoughtful and insightful public policy person. I would strongly recommend his book, Going with a Grain, or Working with a Grain, I think. Working with the Grain is a great example of how do you make governance changes, public policy improvements, which are not just technically best, but are based on technical foundations, but are also pragmatic and are politically feasible. I would say a must-read book for everyone. Okay, so over to you. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Rai Sao?
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you so much. And thank you, Professor. That was really nice, great presentation. Just give a good insight about this great university. I think I want to follow up a bit on the question from the previous person who asked around the quota, but for me, it's going to be more on women. So I just wanted to know, South Africa is one of the fewer countries in Africa that has like a full quota in place, but also has a over 40% women in parliament. They have got now 42%. So I would be quite curious to know how they managed to get that. Is it because is the apartheid has something to do with it, or because of the fight women, were involved in the apartheid or ANC? If you have any, background or any explanation you could provide to really help me understand why, how they managed to get, more women compared to other African countries. Thank you.
Lovely question and interesting one. The political party, it happens because the political parties are generally committed to a high level of female representation in them. Now the question obviously is why. And it's true that in the ANC, I think there were two important factors. The one was that, although it's, undoubtedly was a patriarch and remains a somewhat patriarchal institution, women played a significant role and continue to play a significant role. So our current Minister of Foreign Affairs, who was recently in Britain as a guest at the G7 meeting, is a woman. One of our greatest, in fact, in my view, our greatest deputy president, Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, who is now the head of UN Women, was very prominent. And there are a number, usually the cabinet is probably as representative of women as the parliament is, at least 40%, sometimes more. I think that's because of the role of women in the struggle for liberation, which has always been significant and has always been celebrated, even though sometimes celebrated more symbolically than in practice. The real pressure that women have applied, but also the fact that I think the, you know, the leadership of the ANC and the leadership of the organizations which are close to the ANC, particularly the trade union movement, which was very important, especially in the transition period. And the Communist Party is a kind of an ally to the ANC, had also strong policies to support the promotion of women. You know, it's not something, you know, there's a lot of talk, and there's not always equal amount of action in relation to the position of women. I think the other thing is actually another person who may be well known outside of South Africa, although perhaps less than Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, is Geraldine Fraser Moleketi, who was also in the UN system for a while. She was the Minister of Public Service and Administration. And when she was Minister of Public Administration, she introduced systems which very powerfully promoted women within the public service, as well as in other institutions. You know, Mandela was a really enlightened leader, you know, not typical, I think, of his generation, but perhaps typical of the group that he was associated with within the ANC, a remarkable group of enlightened leaders, largely men, but quite remarkable people.
Thank you, Ellen. Katie?
Hi, thank you, Adnan, and thank you so much, Alan, for speaking with us. It's been such a fascinating discussion so far. So my question is really about, you described how the sort of growth of South Africa, as I understand it, faced almost a trade-off between inequality and addressing economic growth. And so now, obviously, in the context of the COVID pandemic, I'm just wondering if that is the correct way to frame it, if we're sort of currently facing that trade-off again. And in that context, like, what are the main lessons that should be taken forward for inclusive development that is able to encompass both aspects? And then I guess there's a third axis in there of like a transition towards a green economy, which and, you know, building back better, which perhaps complicates things, but I would love to know what in particular worked for inequality in the past that could be taken forward, or what maybe should have been bolder, like perhaps thinking about the role of land use and redistribution. And then just to maybe add one final complication to the question, you talked a lot about political economy and understanding what's actually feasible. So what are the main barriers for the kinds of policies for inclusive development that you think are necessary in the current context? Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I guess to start off the answer, and I do, if you are really interested in this, I do encourage you to look at our Carnegie endowment paper, which you'll find on their website. I don't think that it was seen really as a trade-off. I think that the way that it was seen in 1994 was that it was it was not a zero-sum game. It was a win-win possibility that there could be a return to economic growth with a lot of the old economic establishment in power, but also a transformation at the same time. And that transformation was going to take place through kind of a corporate structure, which was actually kind of logical for South Africa. One of the first laws that was passed by the South African government was the National Economic Development and Labour Act. And that was an act to establish, or Labour Council Act. It was an act to establish a council of government, business, labor, and a community component, always controversial because that's difficult to structure. But the trade unions, business, and government were meeting regularly, and they were trying to formulate policies jointly that would be beneficial for all parties. problem was that the all parties didn't really represent the unemployed. So the community constituency wasn't very strongly represented. So what you actually ended up with was a system where rents were shared between big labor and big business and government effectively. And the structure of, we had a peculiar situation where labor protected itself through very strong laws to defend labor rights, which at the same time had the effect of limiting the possibility for small and medium businesses to compete because of the high levels of requirements, health requirements, and various other requirements that firms had to comply with. And the ministers were very sympathetic. Most of the ministers of labor came from the labor movement and were very sympathetic to the labor movement. So that was strongly enforced. And the opportunities for a broader kind of economic development, I think, were missed at that time. So even if the philosophy was some sort of trickle-down effect, the structures didn't allow for a trickle-down effect. You had South Africa has always had, and probably continues to have, a disproportionate number of people employed in and output from big companies, and a very small, much smaller proportion from small and medium companies. So it was a very peculiar outcome. What could have been done differently, and what was constraining it? I think that, you know, we try in the paper and some other papers I've written to distinguish between what went wrong but didn't have to go wrong and what was pretty unavoidable. And it's quite a difficult analytical exercise. I think land could have been redistributed more radically at the time. I'm not sure it would have made a big difference in terms of rural land, which was the most unequally distributed, but it would have had a significant difference in terms of urban land. I think that we could have intervened more in the structure of business, but what was constraining that was a fear that any sort of significant interference in the way that business did its business would lead to in the departure of either the capitalists themselves, the people who were running the businesses and who owned the businesses, who were obviously internationally mobile, or the international investors, or both. Because South Africa is heavily dependent on raising funds on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, the JSE, which is an unusually active and large institution. So the system was very, very sensitive to political interference, and there was a fear that was drummed into the ANC leadership by business in the transition period, which business managed very well. I have an article about that, which came out the beginning of this year in the South African Journal of International Affairs, called Fatal Embrace, because I described the relationship between the ANC and the business community in that transition period as a fatal embrace. It was fatal to both, because in the end, both business and ordinary people lost out. The dynamism of the economy and the opportunity to build a dynamic economy was lost because there wasn't enough restructuring of an economy that was built for a archaic apartheid system. And the interventions that would have supported poor people were also not undertaken. There are people who say the ANC sold out in the 90s. There are other people who say there really wasn't a big choice. There were some bad choices made, but the big choices were not available because of these circumstances, which I described earlier when I said, put yourself in Mandela's shoes. It wasn't an easy position to be in, to being a black leader of a new country in a difficult time in the world. So people were afraid to change too much too quickly. and then got caught in the status quo situation.
Thank you, Ellen. So unless anyone has a final question, so I do have a question, which is moving beyond South Africa, thinking of Africa as a whole, it has achieved quite a lot, but in the eyes of many, given its potential, it has also underachieved. So looking into the future, are you optimistic about Africa? And obviously one has to be optimistic, but if yes, what are the grounds of that optimism?
Well, Africans have a kind of a stock answer to that question at the moment. And that is, you know, Africa is 55 countries, more countries than any other continent, I think. And a lot of small countries, a lot of big countries, a lot of democratic countries, a lot of somewhat democratic countries, quite a few authoritarian countries, some landlocked countries, some coastal countries, some resource-rich countries, some resource-poor countries. There's such a variation in Africa. It's very hard to generalize. But I think that, I mean, overall, I'm optimistic. The last 20 years, well, really the last 25 years, if you look at the long-term growth and poverty and health and education data, there's a kind of a turning point in 1995, or around about 1995. Why that happened exactly at that time, I'm not sure. I've tried to explain it at various times, but I'm not going to try to go into it now. But I think the end of the Cold War was really important, more important than many people accept, because the Cold War had meant that both sides, the East and the West, were shoring up regimes that had no accountability to their people. Africans had to become more accountable to their people after the Cold War, when there wasn't money coming in from Moscow or from Washington or wherever. So I think that was a really, really important part of the change. The improvements in governments, they're more democratic countries. And that trend has continued. There have been hiccups. But overall, the average rate of growth of Africa has been reasonably strong. And there are a number of African countries which have had high rates of growth over a long period of time. And I think that those will have kind of neighborhood effects in the medium to long term, and for very different reasons. Some of them are really have good institutions. So I think there are countries like Mauritius, countries like Ghana, which has somehow managed to establish really strong institutions. I think South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, to a certain extent, have reasonably strong institutions, and they can help to support growth when they're not misused. Some are able to ride the resource booms with greater skill than in the past. Ghana is an interesting example of that as well, with the oil boom, which it first managed very badly and then learned to manage somewhat better. I think that African leaders have learned from the past. You know, having been in politics and academia for so long, I'm often tempted to rely on the cliche that, you know, history repeats itself and people have very short memories, and politicians especially have very short memories. But I think that some of the lessons have been learned, and they've been learned not only by the politicians, but by the intellectuals who support the politicians. So institutions like the African Economic Research Consortium, which is funded by various international institutions and foundations, built up a really strong group of economists across Africa, some of whom stayed in Africa, some of whom left Africa to be professors all around the world. Enough stayed in Africa to be the central bank governors, to be the ministers of finance, to be the senior officials, to make a big difference. And I think that, so there are a number of reasons why I'm reasonably positive about Africa, although I wouldn't generalize about Africa. There variations, and it's much easier to talk country by country or region by region.
Well said, Ellen. So let's end on this positive note. I think we all want everyone to have a hopefully a real but a virtual clap as well for Ellen. Thank you very much, Ellen. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to benefit from your wisdom again at some point again.
Thank you. I'd love to be involved in your school in the future if there's some way to do that too. So thank you for the opportunity to meet your students and your colleagues.
Thank you, and goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.